somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 3, The Age of Persecution. In the last episode, we saw how the transformation from republic to empire gradually strangled dissent. Today's episode covers events from the trial of Jesus in the 1st century AD until Emperor Justinian in the 6th. We'll meet Roman emperors, Christian martyrs burned alive, influential church fathers, and the female pagan philosopher murdered by a mob of religious fanatics. These characters played parts in the drama that followed the emergence of Christianity. The Romans reacted with hatred, leading to persecution. Then tolerance grew into acceptance, and ultimately the Christianization of the empire. This development dramatically changed the dynamics in the empire, and the victims became the perpetrators. Throughout these phases, being on the wrong side of what we would call religious tolerance could result in death or torture. The violence could stem from both local officials, the emperor, or frenzied mobs incited by pagan philosophers or Christian bishops. The vicious cycle of religious violence only briefly led to tolerance. Instead, the question of belief, and later orthodoxy of belief, became a zero-sum game of winner takes it all. This had serious consequences for classical learning and philosophy, as well as for diverse Christian and non-Christian sects, as books were censored and burned, and orthodox faith became prized over inquiry and religious diversity. Around 30 BC, Jesus of Nazareth was executed by the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. Why was he executed? Well, that depends on whether you believe the Gospels or modern-day scholars. The former stressed the Jewish charge of blasphemy, the latter, the Roman charge of sedition. One could do a whole expert opinion episode on Jesus' trial, and I just might. Jesus didn't leave as much as a letter behind, so the odds of him planting the seeds of what became the state religion of the empire that executed him were pretty slim. But the strange Jewish sect of Christians soon went viral. 30 years after the crucifixion, Christian communities had sprouted up all over the Eastern Empire and soon penetrated all its parts. Not least due to the indefatigable work of Paul of Tarsus, a.k.a. St. Paul. He had initially persecuted Christians for blaspheming against Judaism, but then converted to Christianity after an epiphany. Here was a man who knew how to use what remnants of libertas was left to spectacular effect. But as Paul would find out the hard way, the Roman Empire, or Babylon, the mother of prostitutes, as it would be referred to in the book of Revelation, was not about to surrender without a fight. The persecutions of early Christians is a controversial matter. Contemporary Roman sources are few, so we have to rely on the Christian winners of history, who in the famous words of 18th century historian Edward Gibbon, ascribe to the magistrates of Rome the same degree of implacable and unrelenting zeal which filled their own breasts. And of course Gibbon himself was no fan of Christianity, and nor were a number of influential 19th and 20th century British historians. Historians often divide the Roman persecution of Christians into three phases. No evidence of persecution exists in the first phase, lasting until a great fire under Emperor Nero. Nero initiated the second phase with his persecution of Christians in 64, but outbreaks of persecution were sporadic and local, or bottom-up. The last phase involved top-down general persecutions from 250 AD by the Emperor Decius, culminating with Diocletian's so-called Great Persecution in 303. It's important to stress that the persecutions were typically brief and included long periods of seemingly peaceful coexistence between pagans and Christians, though Christianity would not be officially tolerated until the Edict of Milan in 313. In 64 AD, a fire devastated Rome. Emperor Nero was already unpopular for being a seriously sick puppy who, it was said, not only bedded his mother, but also had her murdered. Nero's popularity dived further when he commissioned the building of an extravagant golden palace on the newly available spot of prime real estate. Perhaps a scapegoat could quell the rumors that he had torched Rome for his own advantage. And what better choice than a new foreign apocalyptic cult who rejected Roman religious traditions and worshipped a Jew executed for political rebellion against Rome. Half a century after the fire, Tacitus wrote an account of it, which is also one of the first mentions of Christianity outside Christian and Jewish sources.
To stop the rumor, Nero made scapegoats and punished with every refinement the notoriously depraved Christians. First, Nero had the self-admitted Christians arrested. Then, on their information, large numbers of others were condemned, not so much for starting fires as because of their hatred for the human race.
Those who confessed to being Christians were tortured to give up others. The convicted Christians were either thrown to the dogs, crucified, or even burned alive as human torches, while Nero pranced around, dressed as a charioteer, to the disgust of guests invited to the gruesome spectacle. But Nero's horror show was not the beginning of a new imperial policy. For almost 200 years, outbreaks of persecution were initiated by local mobs or officials. Say when anti-Christian hatred exploded and the governor was pressured to take action to appease the mobs and keep law and order. One such governor was Pliny the Younger, proconsul of Bithynia by the Black Sea. Pliny wrote a number of letters to the Emperor Trajan, seeking guidance on how to treat these strange and stubborn Christians, since he had never tried them before. So he tortured two Christians and wrote of it to Trajan.
I have asked them in person if they are Christniks, and if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and third time with a warning of the sanction awaiting them. If they persist, I order them to be led away for execution. For whatever the nature of their admission, I am convinced that their stubbornness and unshakable obstinacy should not go unpunished.
Trajan agreed with Pliny's methods, but added that Christians should not be sought out actively and should be spared if they denounce Christianity and sacrifice to the Roman gods. But why would the polytheistic Romans care about the Christians at all? Last episode, I mentioned the importance of the peace of the gods. This peace was not built on exclusivity. Pay your respect, and neither the gods nor the authorities cared much about what other gods you'd throw into the mix. Sacrifice and ritual, not belief in doctrine, was what mattered. But for Christians, belief in doctrine was crucial. And the one true God had specifically forbidden his followers to worship other gods, So sacrificing to false or demonic Roman deities, including emperors, not only went against belief, it was apostasy, jeopardizing salvation and eternal life. To the Romans, the Christians seemed extremely obstinate and self-righteous by refusing to pay their simple respect to the very gods that had sustained the most successful empire in the history of mankind. It made them atheists, not an honorific title. So the Romans feared the peace of the gods would be jeopardized by the obstinate Christians. Add to this that Christianity initially won converts from the lower classes and tended to create what today we might call parallel societies, with their secret rituals and refusal to obey laws that conflicted with their holy book. So Christians were hated by many pagans in the first and much of the second century. In fact, in the early years, Christians were called a third race, implying that they were subhuman. Another violent persecution broke out in present-day Lyon in 177 during the emperorship of Marcus Aurelius, the kind, stoic philosopher king from Gladiator. Marcus Aurelius was heavily influenced by Greek philosophy. In his famous work, Meditations, he praises freedom of speech and the idea of equal rights and equal freedom of speech. Writing in Greek, it is in fact parrhesia and isagoria that Aurelius praises. He wasn't a fanatical anti-Christian, and for the most part of his rule, Christians were not persecuted. But in 177, things got seriously out of hand. 4th century Christian historian Eusebius gives a graphic account from an anonymous survivor, which, of course, should be treated with caution. The persecution followed anti-Christian riots taking place while the governor was away. Contrary to Trajan's line, a general search for Christians was initiated when the governor returned. He ordered a public trial of the Christians and, assumedly, asked Marcus Aurelius what to do with the Christians. Eusebius recounts a particularly graphic story of a Christian named Sanctus who had burning brass plates fixed to his most delicate parts, but stubbornly refused to reveal anything but the words, Christianus sum, I am a Christian. The Christians in Lyon were not given a chance to renounce their faith or prove their innocence by sacrificing to the Roman gods. Convicted Christians were taken to the amphitheater.
They were dragged about by the wild beasts and suffered every indignity which the maddened people cried out for from around the amphitheater. Last of all, they were placed in the iron chair on which their bodies were roasted. They themselves were filled with the fumes of their own flesh.
Finally, word got back from Marcus Aurelius, who followed Trajan's line. Confess and die, or renounce and live. It seems Aurelius' interpretation of free speech and justice for all was pretty flexible. In his book on liberty, John Stuart Mill used Marcus Aurelius as one of his chief arguments against censorship. Aurelius' writings was the highest ethical product of the ancient mind, and yet he persecuted Christianity. For Mill, this was the perfect example of why no one, no matter how well-intentioned or enlightened, should be given power to rule over the opinions of others. The empire's stability and prosperity in the period of the so-called Five Good Emperors ended with the death of Aurelius and the ascension of his incompetent son, Commodus. Now the empire plummeted into a period with civil wars and invasion, known as the Crisis of the Third Century. And from the death of Aurelius in 180 AD until 270 AD, 80 emperors donned the purple. The many short-lived and incompetent emperors was a hard blow to the imperial cult. Sure, you might just plausibly believe a Trajan, Hadrian, or Marcus Aurelius to be a deity. But Commodus? Or the long line of worthless usurpers killing off each other? Please. Christianity could thus fill a spiritual void, which likely helped it spread like never before, including among the higher social classes. This was a threat to the imperial order, and empire-wide persecutions soon followed. When Decius ascended the throne in 249, he issued an edict demanding all citizens sacrifice on behalf of the emperor. Disobedience was considered treason and could be punished with death. Decius ordered magistrates to enforce the edict and issue certificates as evidence to those who had sacrificed. You can see one on freespeechhistory.com. Scholars disagree on the scope of Decius' decree. There's no doubt that Christians were hard hit, but the decree was applied universally, with the exception of Jews. So Decius' decree need not have been anti-Christian per se. It may have been an attempt to create social cohesion in an empire where religious practice was very fragmented. In a modern context, we could perhaps think of it as a decree ordering everyone to publicly swear allegiance to the Constitution and salute the flag, and that refusal to do so would result in a bullet in the back of the head. The persecutions culminated in a grand finale known as the Great Persecution by Diocletian. He had already warmed up by burning Manichaean spiritual leaders and their books. Now it was time for the Christians to feel the heat. In 299, he had Christian officials flogged. An oracle blamed them for a failed divination, since the Christians had made the sign of the cross. A number of influential pagan philosophers also started campaigning against Christianity. Among them, the Neoplatonist Porphyry of Tyre, who admired Jesus' teachings but found Christians to be polluted, contaminated, and enmeshed in error. Some historians argue that Porphyry may have been at the heart of inciting Diocletian and his more than eager junior emperor Galerius to go all in on persecution. In February 303, Diocletian issued a number of edicts aimed at eradicating Christianity from the empire. All churches were to be destroyed, and meetings for Christian worship were prohibited. Diocletian also reintroduced one of Augustus' old practices. All copies of the Bible and liturgical scriptures were to be burned in public. According to a Christian author, Diocletian ordered the edicts enforced without bloodshed, but there's evidence of Christian refuseniks being executed. Soon, new edicts reducing legal rights of Christians and ordering the arrest of clergy followed. A fourth edict, issued around 304, ordered all inhabitants of the empire to sacrifice on pain of death, which meant the end of the principle of passive persecution. Christians should now be sought out, and no certificates were issued. Christian communities and places of worship were searched, and Christians put under pressure to denounce each other. In Thessaloniki, three women were interrogated by a Roman prefect, demanding to know if they had Christian writings. One of the women, Irene, was charged with having kept
many parchments, books, tablets, codices, and pages of unholy writings of the former Christians.
Irene and the other women were burned alive. In North Africa, 49 Christians defied the ban on worship and met privately to celebrate Sunday Mass. Suddenly, soldiers stormed in. Interrogation and brutal torture followed. When one of the Christians was asked why he had allowed the meeting, he answered, "Because we cannot live without Sunday." Others were asked whether they had illegal scriptures, and several confessed, "They are inscribed in my heart." All 49 Christians were then executed. Despite the draconian nature of the Great Persecution, it was unevenly enforced throughout the empire, with the East being affected the worst. It ended with Galerius's Edict of Toleration from 311, followed by the Edict of Milan 2 years later. Just how deadly were the persecutions of Christians? Well, that's impossible to say with certainty. Gibbon, rather insensitively, wrote that the average annual consumption of martyrs was no more than 150 per year during years of persecution, totaling maybe 2,000. French historian Henri Grégoire has estimated that between 2,500 and 3,000 Christians were executed during the Great Persecution. Historian W.H.C. Friend arrives at a number between 3,000 and 3,500. Given that Diocletian's persecution was the most extensive, the total number of Christian martyrs probably was not much higher than, say, 4,000 to 5,000. The persecution of Christians was no Holocaust, but that should not detract from the horrific nature of the anti-Christian programs. Torture, imprisonment, or a one-way ticket to hard labor in the mines were alternatives to execution. And the social consequences must have touched the lives of tens of thousands more Christians than those executing for saying the words "Christianus sum." The feeling of vulnerability may also have contributed to the zeal with which Christians started persecuting pagans and each other when the marriage between Christianity and empire had been consummated, creating what historian Geoffrey Sainte-Croix provocatively called the greatest organized persecuting force in human history. Persecution had not been able to stop the incredible success of Christianity. And when the faith found a new champion in the form of an emperor, the rise and rise of Christianity would proceed at breakneck speed, easily overcoming a brief reversal. Constantine famously defeated Maxentius at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, where his soldiers fought with the symbol of Christ on their shields. Much has been written on whether Constantine turned to Christianity out of piety or politics. I won't get into that discussion. But though Constantine wasn't baptized until on his deathbed in 337, he instituted a number of policies that favored Orthodox Christianity at the expense of pagans and the unorthodox. But his first move was to ensure protection and equality for the Christians. Galerius's Edict of Toleration was expanded by the so-called Edict of Milan, in reality an agreement between Constantine and his co-emperor Licinius, not only to end persecution of Christians, but to enact universal toleration. It secured
the rights of open and free observance of their worship for the sake of the peace of our times, that each one may have the free opportunity to worship as he pleases.
Some 500 years after Ashoka had introduced it in India, full toleration came to Europe. The Edict of Milan is an important milestone in the history of freedom of thought. But unity would soon become more important than tolerance for Constantine. There had already been violent splits, creating new offshoots of Arian and Donatist Christians. Arians held that Christ was inferior to the Father. Donatists were incensed at the idea of reinstating clergy who had renounced Christianity during the persecution. In 325, Constantine presided over the Council of Nicaea, attempting once and for all to settle the nature of Orthodox belief among the squabbling sects. But not everyone was willing to toe the Nicene line, and so the spirit of toleration had to give. As early as 314, Constantine had ordered anonymous pamphlets burned and their authors executed under a treason law. Now books that fell foul of the Nicene Creed were sought out and destroyed. Possessing Arian books was a capital offense. Egged on by revengeous Christian writers, Constantine also sought to avenge the great persecution by banning the books of Porphyry, whose anti-Christian writings had incited Diocletian. A vicious cycle had begun. But then, in 361, Julian unexpectedly became emperor. He had been brought up as a Christian, but through intense studies of classical philosophy, he found the light and sought to reinvigorate paganism. Hence, he is known to us as Julian the Apostate. Julian is often portrayed either as a noble champion of learning and reason against obscurantist Christians, or as a devious pagan seeking to destroy Christianity. Most famously, he issued an edict discriminating against Christian teachers in higher education. And he also purged Christian officials and army officers. His limited censorship targeted both pagan poetry and comedy, as well as the books of specific Christian enemies. But he never matched the severity of previous persecutions, nor the extreme intolerance to come. Julian died campaigning in Syria in 363. His reign was too short to change the religious dynamics of the empire. And anyway, the paganism he tried to revive was in terminal decay, while the universalist message of Christianity, with its sense of community and promise of eternal salvation for all who believed, was winning new converts daily. Soon the cross would be swept in purple again. Initially, pagans were not specifically targeted by Julian's Christian successors. Laws against astrology, divination, and magic were adopted for fear of conspiracy. But the definition was so wide that many of those affected by the ensuing magic trials were pagan philosophers and their writings, which were severely affected in the eastern part of the empire. The contemporary accounts of these trials sound eerily similar to the ones suffered by Christian martyrs.
Some were executed without delay or breathing space, while the examination of whether they should be punished was still ongoing, and the whole scene appeared to be a slaughter of cattle. Then innumerable books and many heaps of scrolls were piled up and burned. Most of them were titles on various liberal arts and on law.
The steady drip-drip of laws in favor of orthodoxy and against paganism turned into a torrent when Theodosius became emperor in 379 and declared Christianity the official state religion of the empire in 380. In the edict of 380, he started out innocently enough. By his clemency, he wished all people to follow orthodoxy and embrace the name of Catholic Christians. But then the tone changed.
The rest, however, whom we adjudge demented and insane, shall sustain the infamy of heretical dogmas. Their meeting places shall not receive the name of churches, and they shall be smitten first by divine vengeance, and secondly by the retribution of our own initiative, which we shall assume in accordance with the divine judgment.
But Theodosius was just getting warmed up. No other emperor issued more laws against pagans and heretics than Theodosius, although Justinian would give him a good run for his money. In 388, a mob of Christians attacked a Jewish synagogue in modern-day Raqqa, Syria. They burned it to the ground. Despite his Christian seal, Emperor Theodosius held the local Christian leader responsible for the outbreak of violence and demanded that he pay compensation. But then stepped in Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan. In letters and sermons, he dressed down Theodosius and warned him strongly against protecting the rights of the Jews.
What has the pious in common with the unpious? The instances of his unbelief ought to be done away with together with the unbeliever himself.
In the end, Theodosius backed down. The Theodosian dynasty's flurry of laws would be compiled in the Codex Theodosianus from 438. A veritable a la carte menu of religious intolerance, including some 66 laws against heresy alone. Just as Augustus and Tiberius had expanded the scope of treason to include criticism of themselves, Theodosius and his successors added the scope further still to include religious crimes, which could mean just about anything. Going to temples and sacrificing was totally out of the question. It was made a capital crime to disclose to others the content of banned pamphlets. Even the mere discussion of religion as such was prohibited in 386, lest Christians should be subdued by pagan rhetoric. And Jews and Samaritans were banned from holding public office. Why would Christians persecute pagans and each other? Consolidation of power and fear of the former persecutors likely influenced these policies. But belief surely played a major role. Just like their pagan persecutors, Christians too were motivated by fear of the wrath of God. The Roman gods would be angered if people didn't sacrifice to them. But the Christian God would get upset if people recognized any other gods than him. In fact, recognizing him as the one true God was not enough. He might also exact his revenge if you believed in him in the wrong way. That message was heavily emphasized by a number of influential church fathers whose writings shaped attitudes towards tolerance as Christianity became the dominant religion. And this may be a good time to meet one of the most prominent, Augustine of Hippo. Even today, his City of God inspires many Christians. And Augustine's contribution to Christianity and intellectual pursuit are many. So his attitude towards tolerance obviously does not define his thought or significance. Even so, Augustine was an enthusiastic supporter of the removal and destruction of pagan books, symbols, and temples. In one sermon he preached,
"That all superstition of pagans and heathens should be annihilated is what God wants, God commands, God proclaims."
Initially, Augustine was tolerant towards other Christians. Faith depended on persuasion, not power. But as the Donatist conflict intensified at the end of the 4th century, he argued in favor of coercion, famously invoking Luke chapter 14, verse 23, "Compel them to come in." Another specialty of Augustine's was to justify coercion with reference to love and medical metaphors. Heretics and schismatics were sick and needed to be forcibly healed through tough love, to save them from damnation, and to ensure the unity and health of the Catholic Church. The medicine ordained? Floggings. Despite the avalanche of intolerant laws under Theodosius and his successors, we don't have much evidence that they were scrupulously enforced. There was nothing like the mass executions of Christians that took place under Diocletian. But just like pagans had often engaged in mob violence and incited officials against Christians, now Christian clerics, monks, and citizens took to the streets to settle theological differences through force. The powder keg atmosphere of Alexandria was particularly prone to violent conflicts. And two instances had serious consequences for learning and free thought. In 391, Christians ransacked a temple, mockingly parading the stolen symbols around the city. Pagans retaliated, and deadly violence broke out. The pagans barricaded themselves in the grandiose temple of Serapis, which also hosted the Serapeum, a daughter library to the famous Great Library. With the support of Theodosius, the violent bishop Theophilus and his supporters attacked the temple, which was utterly destroyed, along with all the books that may have numbered more than 40,000. Gibbon wrote about the incident.
The valuable library of Alexandria was pillaged or destroyed, and near 20 years afterwards, the appearance of the empty shelves excited the regret and indignation of every spectator whose mind was not totally darkened by religious prejudice.
Historian of medieval Europe James Hannam argues that Gibbon was misled by his anti-Christian bias and that the library had been removed before the destruction of the Serapeum. But in my non-expert opinion, Mustafa El Abadi and Dirk Roman, both specialists in late antiquity, offer more persuasive arguments for the view that Theophilus destroyed both bricks and books. Perhaps no other instance of deadly religious mob violence is more tragic than the fate of Hypatia. She was a brilliant mathematician and philosopher, and greatly admired in Alexandria, the intellectual capital of the empire, where she would teach in the presence of students flocking from near and far. She is said to have been as beautiful as she was brainy, but wholly disinterested in human chemistry. According to tradition, one of Hypatia's students fell helplessly in love with her. To say he was rejected would be an understatement. She flung out one of her used menstrual rags and told her admirer, "This is what you love, young man, and it isn't beautiful." There are different accounts of why and how Hypatia was killed. But it seems she got scapegoated for the breakdown in relations between the governor of Alexandria and yet another fanatical bishop, Cyril. He imposed his intolerant brand of Christianity with the help of violent monks cum thugs. The Christian population, likely egged on by Cyril, started a campaign against Hypatia, painting her as a dangerous and evil magician. The 7th century Bishop John of Nicaea wrote that Hypatia
was devoted at all times to magic, astrolabes, and instruments of music, and she beguiled many people through her satanic wiles. And the governor of the city honored her exceedingly, for she had beguiled him through her magic, and he ceased attending church as had been his custom.
The incitement against Hypatia culminated during Lent of 415, when a mob of Christians grabbed Hypatia and dragged her through the streets to a church. In one account, her assailants stripped her naked and used broken tiles to cut the flesh off her body. The mutilated remains of Alexandria's most brilliant thinker and scientist were given an encore through the streets of Alexandria for the most macabre of triumphs, before it was unceremoniously burnt. I don't know about you, but the mob's gleeful execution of Hypatia still moves me deeply, even though it took place more than 1,500 years ago. Imagine what must have gone through Hypatia's head as she was being dragged to her death, or as the first tiles cut into her flesh while the hands of hostile strangers held her down. And what went through the heads of those doing the dragging and cutting? Did they truly believe they were serving a higher purpose? We may actually come close to get an idea of how Hypatia's death unfolded. For despite the passing of 1,500 years, human nature can still give in to the impulses that cut short Hypatia's life. In 2015, the mentally ill Afghan woman Fakunda Malikzadeh was falsely accused of having burned a Quran. This caused a frenzied mob of religious fanatics to beat her to death. Then her corpse was run over and dragged behind a car, driven to a riverbank in Kabul, where it was dumped, stoned, and then finally burned among piles of garbage. Unlike the case of Hypatia, we don't have to imagine how this happened. For the mob that enforced its own version of 7th century religious dogmas used 21st century technology to record their deeds, holding up smartphones to catch the frenzy descending on the defenseless Fakunda. You can still watch these clips online, though I advise against it. After the fall of the Western Empire in 476, the eastern half of the Roman Empire, aka the Byzantine Empire, continued on. The most famous of the eastern emperors is Justinian, who ruled from 527 to 565. Among his many achievements was the collection of a legal code that still holds influence today. But the Codex Justinianus also includes many laws that were far less progressive. To an even higher degree than Constantine, Justinian was obsessed with religious orthodoxy and unity. One empire, one faith, one church was his motto. Perhaps the most infamous of Justinian's acts was his decision in 529 to close the academy in Athens, which could trace its intellectual roots back to Plato himself. Even though its intellectual heyday was long past, the closing of the academy had a hugely symbolic impact. Some modern scholars even date the end of antiquity to this event. But Justinian's ambitions were not limited to a failing academy. He wanted to purge the empire from pagan ideas and philosophy, root and branch. In 529 and 531, Justinian banned all affected by the disease of heresy, which included both pagans and non-Orthodox Christians, from becoming teachers.
We forbid the teaching of any doctrine by those who suffer from the madness of the unholy pagans.
But the teacher bans were actually mild compared to what else Justinian had in store. Death penalty for anyone sacrificing or worshipping idols, and for Christians engaged in pagan practices. For pagans, there would be no more enjoyment of civil rights and property unless baptized and instructed in the Christian faith. Jews were mentioned 33 times in the Codex, and their religious rights, long respected, were now limited. Construction of synagogues was restricted, and certain religious texts banned. In 539, Justinian instituted the death penalty for blasphemy, lest God in his wrath may destroy the cities and their inhabitants. The Theodosian Code had failed to stamp out all heresy and paganism. The lesson Justinian learned was that you can't rely on laws alone. You need enforcers. Historian Dirk Roman argues that a mostly overlooked source suggests that Justinian not only talked the talk, he walked the walk when it came to religious persecution. To get the job done, he appointed a chief inquisitor, a brutal military official called Amantius, who operated out of Antioch in Syria. He ruthlessly sought out pagans, atheists, and heretics, seized and burned their books in public, and then conducted religious trials that included torture and perhaps sometimes capital punishments, including people being flogged to death. To confiscate as many illegal books as possible, Amantius used a good cop, bad cop tactic. If you were caught with scientific or pagan literature, you could escape punishment by becoming an informant, denouncing others with the clandestine books. Given the choice between a trial involving torture and being led off with repentance, it's not surprising that many chose to rat out other heretics. This may have spared many a life, for these policies did not result in mass execution of pagans, as has happened to Christians before Constantine, but caused the loss of untold books burned by the new Inquisition. The public display of punishments was central in order to exorcise the evils of the suppressed ideas and to scare the population into abstaining from such wickedness. One source mentions how a couple of blasphemers had their hands cut off and were paraded around Constantinople on camels. Another boasts of how pagans
were arrested and paraded around and their books were burned in public together with pictures and statues of their disgusting gods.
What did all this mean? Traditional pagan beliefs were already in decline, but the systematic banning, censorship, and destruction of pagan texts and places of worship must surely have sped up the process considerably. The persecutions of heretical Christians also took its toll. There aren't many Arians, Donatists, or Nestorians around. If it's difficult for moderns to mourn the extinction of pagan religion, then consider the consequences for free thought, reason, and science. If you want to read Porphyry's attack against the Christians, you'll have to search through fragments quoted in the books of his Christian opponents. Of Hypatia's works, only bits survive. In fact, scholars estimate that only 90% of the known works of antiquity and a mere 1% of the Latin texts have survived. Book burnings and censorship only account for a minority of the lost works. Much has been perished by the closing of the Orthodox mind that was the consequence of the intolerant climate. Dedicated monks in Christian monasteries played a crucial part in saving much of what classical literature does survive. But often the monks would let pagan works rot away or scrub the books to make space for yet another copy of the New Testament. This had serious consequences for knowledge, philosophy, and science. What, if any, lessons can people in our time learn from the age of persecution? One way to look at it is to say, persecuting ideas is not only morally reprehensible, it doesn't work. You can kill people, but you can't kill ideas. The most powerful empire in the world tried to root out Christianity, and even though they martyred thousands and tortured even more, Christianity survived and became the state religion. By persecuting Christians, pagans initiated a vicious cycle, ending with their own persecution. So even if you loathe the ideas followed by a minority, you should tolerate them, because you never know when you will be in the minority yourself. A more cynical person might say, the Romans didn't err in persecuting the Christians. They erred in not trying hard enough. A couple of poorly enforced general persecutions over 3 centuries would never do the trick. And look what happened. A small marginal cult grew into the state religion, which criminalized wrong belief, and within a few centuries, paganism was all but dead. Tolerance is just a fancy word for suicide pact. If you're on the side of truth and justice, no quarter should be given to the enemy of these ideals. While the anti-pagan policies of the Christian Empire had consequences for the transmission of classical learning in the following centuries, it would be wrong to paint the Middle Ages as a dark age of doom and gloom. Amid the intolerant climate, centers of learning, reason, and inquiry would survive and later thrive in both the new Islamic lands and Christendom. This would give impetus to a 12th century renaissance and explosions of science, reason, and thinking, including the rediscovery of the classical learning that had been marginalized. But persecution would also return with a vengeance. So medieval Europe would see both the establishment of universities and the persecuting society. It is to these developments we turn in the next regular episodes. But first, it's time for a couple of expert opinions. First up, one of the world's most eminent scholars of ancient Greece, Cambridge professor Paul Cartledge. That's next week. Thanks for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stahøj, and Matthias Meyer contributed with valuable research. Make sure to give us your feedback and do leave a review on iTunes.